a blank space. One of his probes, H38, he had called it, was deleted in both chromosomes in that tumor. He felt the brief hot rush of ecstasy, which then tipped into queasiness. It was at that moment that I had the feeling that we had a gene in our hands. I had landed on retinoblastoma. Dreja had found a piece of DNA missing in tumor cells. Now he needed to find the corresponding piece present in normal cells, thus isolating the RB gene. Perilously close to the end, Dreja was like an acrobat at the final stretch of his rope. His one-room lab was taut with tension, stretched to its limit. He had inadequate skills in isolating genes and limited resources. To isolate the gene, he would need help, so he took another lunge. He had heard that researchers in the Weinberg lab were also hunting for the retinoblastoma gene. Dreja's choices were stark. He could either team up with Weinberg, or he could try to isolate the gene alone and lose the race altogether. The scientist in Weinberg's lab trying to isolate RB was Steve Friend, a jovial, medically trained molecular geneticist with a quick wit and an easy manner. Friend had casually mentioned his interest in RB to Dreja at a meeting. Unlike Dreja, working with his growing stash of tumor samples, Friend had been building a collection of normal cells, cells in which the RB gene was completely intact. Friend's approach had been to find genes that were present in normal retinal cells, then try to identify ones that were abnormal in retinoblastoma tumors, working backward toward Dreja. For Dreja, the complementarity of the two approaches was obvious. He had identified a missing piece of DNA in tumors. Could Friend and Weinberg now pull the intact, full-length gene out of normal cells? They outlined a potential collaboration between the two labs. One morning in 1985, Dreja took his probe, H38, and virtually ran across the Longfellow Bridge, by now the central highway of oncogenesis, carrying it by hand to Friend's bench at the Whitehead. It took Friend a quick experiment to test Dreja's probe. Using the DNA sticking reaction again, Friend trapped and isolated the normal cellular gene that stuck to the H38 probe. The isolated gene lived on chromosome 13, as predicted. When Dreja further tested the candidate gene through his bank of tumor samples, he found precisely what Knudsen had hypothesized more than a decade earlier. All retinoblastoma cells contained inactivations in both copies of the gene, two hits, while normal cells contained two normal copies of the gene. The candidate gene that Friend had isolated was indisputably RB. In October 1986, Friend, Weinberg, and Dreja published their findings in Nature. The article marked the perfect complement to Weinberg's RAS paper, the yin to its yang. The isolation of an activated proto-oncogene, RAS, and the identification of the anti-oncogene, RB. 15 years ago, Weinberg wrote, Knudsen provided a theoretical basis for retinoblastoma tumorigenesis by suggesting that minimally two genetic events are required to trigger tumor development, Weinberg noted. We have isolated a human gene apparently representing one of this class of genes, a tumor suppressor. What RB does in normal cells is still an unfolding puzzle. Its name, as it turns out, is quite a misnomer. RB, retinoblastoma, is not just mutated in rare eye tumors in children. When scientists tested the gene isolated by Dreja, Friend, and Weinberg in other cancers in the early 90s, they found it widely mutated in lung, bone, esophageal, breast, and bladder cancers in adults. Like RAS, it is expressed in nearly every dividing cell, and it is inactivated in a whole host of malignancies. Calling it retinoblastoma thus vastly underestimates the influence, depth, and prowess of this gene. The retinoblastoma gene encodes a protein, also named RB, with a deep molecular pocket. Its chief function is to bind to several other proteins and keep them tightly sealed in that pocket, preventing them from activating cell division. When the cell decides to divide, it tags RB with a phosphate group, a molecular signal that inactivates the gene and thus forces the protein to release its partners. RB thus acts as a gatekeeper for cell division, opening a series of key molecular floodgates each time cell division is activated and closing them sharply when the cell division is completed. Mutations in RB inactivate this function. The cancer cell perceives its gates as perpetually open and is unable to stop dividing. The cloning of RAS and retinoblastoma, oncogene and anti-oncogene, was a transformative moment in cancer genetics. In the decade between 1983 and 1993, a horde of other oncogenes and anti-oncogenes, tumor suppressor genes, were swiftly identified in human cancers. MYC, MYC, NEU, NU, FOS, FOS, RET, RET, AKT, ACT, all oncogenes, and P53, VHL, APC, all tumor suppressors. Retroviruses, the accidental carriers of oncogenes, faded far into the distance. Varmus and Bishop's theory that oncogenes were activated cellular genes was recognized to be widely true for many forms of cancer. And the two-hit hypothesis, that tumor suppressors were genes that needed to be inactivated in both chromosomes, was also found to be widely applicable in cancer. A rather general conceptual framework for carcinogenesis was slowly becoming apparent. The cancer cell was a broken, deranged machine. Oncogenes were its jammed accelerators, and inactivated tumor suppressors its missing brakes. Although cancer is not universally caused by viruses, certain viruses cause particular cancers, such as the human papillomavirus, HPV, which causes cervical cancer. When the mechanism driving this cancer was deciphered in the 1990s, HPV turned out to inactivate RB's and P53's signal, underscoring the importance of endogenous genes in even virally induced cancers. In the late 1980s, yet another line of research, resurrected from the past, yielded a further bounty of cancer-linked genes. Ever since De Gouveia's report of the Brazilian family with eye tumors in 1872, geneticists had uncovered several other families that appeared to carry cancer in their genes. The stories of these families bore a familiar, tragic trope. Cancer haunted them generation upon generation, appearing and reappearing in parents, children, and grandchildren. Two features stood out in these family histories. First, geneticists recognized that the spectrum of cancers in every family was limited and often stereotypical. Colon and ovarian cancer threading through one family, breast and ovarian through another, sarcomas, leukemias, and gliomas through a third. And second, similar patterns often reappeared in different families, thereby suggesting a common genetic syndrome. In Lynch syndrome, first described by an astute oncologist, Henry Lynch, in a Nebraskan family, colon, ovarian, stomach, and biliary cancer recurred generation upon generation. In Lee Fraumeni syndrome, there were recurrent bone and visceral sarcomas, leukemias, and brain tumors. Using powerful molecular genetic techniques, cancer geneticists in the 1980s and 1990s could clone and identify some of these cancer-linked genes. Many of these familial cancer genes, like RB, were tumor suppressors, although occasional oncogenes were also found. Most such syndromes were fleetingly rare. But occasionally, geneticists identified cancer-predisposing gene alterations that were quite frequently represented in the population. Perhaps the most striking among these first suggested by the geneticist Mary Claire King, and then definitively cloned by Mark Skolnick's team at the pharma company Myriad Genetics, was BRCA1, a gene that strongly predisposes humans to breast and ovarian cancer. BRCA1 can be found in up to 1% of women in selected populations, making it one of the most common cancer-linked genes found in humans. By the early 1990s, the discoveries of cancer biology had thus traversed the gap between the chicken tumors of Peyton Rouse and real human cancers. But purists still complained. The crusty specter of Robert Koch still haunted the genetic theory of cancer. Koch had postulated that for an agent to be identified as the cause of a disease, it must, 1, be present in the diseased organism, 2, be capable of being isolated from the diseased organism, and 3, recreate the disease in a secondary host when transferred from the diseased organism. Oncogenes had met the first two criteria. They had been found to be present in cancer cells, and they had been isolated from cancer cells. But no one had shown that a cancer gene, in and of itself, could create a bona fide tumor in an animal. In the mid-1980s, a series of remarkable experiments allowed cancer geneticists to meet Koch's final criteria. In 1984, biologists working on stem cells had invented a new technology that allowed them to introduce exogenous genes into early mouse embryos, then create a living mouse out of those modified embryos. This allowed them to produce transgenic mice, mice in which one or more genes were artificially and permanently modified. Cancer geneticists seized this opportunity. Among the first such genes to be engineered into a mouse was c-MYC, an oncogene discovered in lymphoma cells. Using transgenic mouse technology, Philip Leder's team at Harvard altered the c-MYC gene in mice, but with a twist. Cleverly, they ensured that only breast tissue in the mouse would overexpress the gene. MYC could not be activated in all cells. If MYC was permanently activated in the embryo turned into a ball of overproliferating cells, then involuted and died through unknown mechanisms. The only way to activate MYC in a living mouse was to restrict the activation to only a subset of cells. Since Leder's lab was studying breast cancer, he chose breast cells. Colloquially, Leder called his mouse the Onco Mouse. In 1988, he successfully applied for a patent on the Onco Mouse, making it the first animal patented in history. Leder expected his transgenic mice to explode with cancer, but to his surprise, the Onco Mice sprouted rather mousy cancers. Even though an aggressive oncogene had been stitched into their chromosomes, the mice developed small unilateral breast cancers, and not until late in life. Even more surprisingly, Leder's mice typically developed cancers only after pregnancy, suggesting that environmental influences, such as hormones, were strictly required to achieve full transformation of breast cells. The active MYC gene does not appear to be sufficient for the development of these tumors, Leder wrote. If that were the case, we would have expected the uniform development of tumor masses involving the entire bilateral breast glands of all 5 tumor-bearing animals. Rather, our results suggest at least 2 additional requirements. One of these is likely to be a further transforming event. The other seems to be a hormonal environment related to pregnancy that is only suggested by these initial studies. To test the roles of other oncogenes and environmental stimuli, Leder created a second oncomouse in which 2 activated proto-oncogenes, RAS and MYC, were engineered into the chromosome and expressed in breast cells. Multiple tumors sprouted up in the breast glands of these mice in months. The requirement for the hormonal milieu of pregnancy was partially ameliorated. Still, only a few distinct clones of cancer sprouted out of the RAS-MYC mice. Millions of breast cells in each mouse possessed activated RAS and MYC. Yet of those millions of cells, each endowed with the most potent oncogenes, only a few dozen turned into real, living tumors. Even so, this was a landmark experiment. Cancer had artificially been created in an animal. Cancer genetics, as the geneticist Cliff Tabin recalls, had crossed a new frontier. It was not dealing with just genes and pathways and artificial lumps in the lab, but a real growing tumor in an animal. Peyton Rouse's long squabble with the discipline, that cancer had never been produced in a living organism by altering a defined set of cellular genes, was finally laid to its long overdue rest. The hallmarks of cancer. I do not wish to achieve immortality through my works. I wish to achieve immortality by not dying. Woody Allen. Scurrying about in its cage in the vivarium atop Harvard Medical School, Philip Leder's oncomouse bore large implications on small haunches. The mouse embodied the maturity of cancer genetics. Scientists had created real, living tumors, not just abstract, etiolated foci in petri dishes, by artificially manipulating two genes, RAS and MYC, in an animal. Yet Leder's experiment raised further questions about the genesis of cancer. Cancer is not merely a lump in the body. It is a disease that migrates, evolves, invades organs, destroys tissues, and resists drugs. Activating even two potent proto-oncogenes had not recapitulated the full syndrome of cancer in every cell of the mouse. Cancer genetics had illuminated much about the genesis of cancer, but much, evidently, remained to be understood. If two oncogenes were insufficient to create cancers, then how many activated proto-oncogenes and inactivated tumor suppressors were required? What were the genetic steps needed to convert a normal cell into a cancer cell? For human cancers, these questions could not be answered experimentally. One could not, after all, proactively create a human cancer and follow the activation and inactivation of genes. But the questions could be answered retrospectively. In 1988, using human specimens, a physician scientist named Bert Vogelstein at Johns Hopkins Medical School in Baltimore set out to describe the number of genetic changes required to initiate cancer. The query, in various incarnations, would preoccupy Vogelstein for nearly two decades. Vogelstein was inspired by the observations made by George Papanicolaou and Oscar Auerbach in the 1950s. Both Papanicolaou and Auerbach, working on different cancers, had noted that cancer did not arise directly out of a normal cell. Instead, cancer often slouched toward its birth, undergoing discrete transitional stages between the fully normal and the frankly malignant cell. Decades before cervical cancer evolved into its fiercely invasive incarnation, whorls of non-invasive pre-malignant cells could be observed in the tissue, beginning their first steps in the grisly march toward cancer. Identifying and eradicating this pre-malignant stage before the cancer spreads is the basis for the Pap smear. Similarly, Auerbach had noted, pre-malignant cells were seen in smokers' lungs long before lung cancer appeared. Colon cancer in humans also underwent graded and discrete changes in its progression, from a non-invasive pre-malignant lesion called an adenoma to the highly invasive terminal stage called an invasive carcinoma. Vogelstein chose to study this progression in colon cancer. He collected samples from patients representing each of the stages of colon cancer. He then assembled a series of four human cancer genes, oncogenes, and tumor suppressors, and assessed each stage of cancer in his samples for activations and inactivations of these four genes. In 1988, the precise identity of only one gene, RAS, was known. The other three were suspected human anti-oncogenes, although their identity would only become known later. Knowing the heterogeneity of every cancer, One might naively have presumed that every patient's cancer possessed its own sequence of gene mutations and its unique set of mutated genes. But Bogelstein found a strikingly consistent pattern in his colon cancer samples. Across many samples and many patients, the transitions in the stages of cancer were paralleled by the same transitions in genetic changes. Cancer cells did not activate or inactivate genes at random. Instead, the shift from a pre-malignant state to an invasive cancer could precisely be correlated with the activation and inactivation of genes in a strict and stereotypical sequence. In 1988, in the New England Journal of Medicine, Vogelstein wrote, "The four molecular alterations accumulated in a fashion that paralleled the clinical progression of tumors." He proposed, "Early in the neoplastic process, one colonic cell appears to outgrow its companions to form a small, benign neoplasm. During the growth of these cells, a mutation in the RAS gene often occurs. Finally, a loss of tumor suppressor genes may be associated with the progression of adenoma to frank carcinoma." Since Vogelstein had pre-selected his list of four genes, he could not enumerate the total number of genes required for the march of cancer. The technology available in 1988 would not permit such an analysis. He would need to wait two decades before that technology would become available. But he had proved an important point, that such a discrete genetic march existed. Papanikolaou and Auerbach had described the pathological transition of cancer as a multi-step process, starting with pre-malignancy and marching inexorably toward invasive cancer. Vogelstein showed that the genetic progression of cancer was also a multi-step process. This was a relief. In the decade between 1980 and 1990, proto-oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes had been discovered in such astonishing numbers in the human genome, at last count about 100 such genes, that their abundance raised a disturbing question. If the genome was so densely littered with such intemperate genes, genes waiting to push a cell toward cancer as if at the flick of a switch, then why was the human body not exploding with cancer every minute? Cancer geneticists already knew two answers to this question. First, proto-oncogenes need to be activated through mutations, and mutations are rare events. Second, tumor suppressor genes need to be inactivated, but typically two copies exist of each tumor suppressor gene, and thus two independent mutations are needed to inactivate a tumor suppressor, an even rarer event. Vogelstein provided the third answer. Activating or inactivating any single gene, he postulated, produced only the first steps toward carcinogenesis. Cancer's march was long and slow and proceeded through many mutations in many genes over many iterations. In genetic terms, our cells were not sitting on the edge of the abyss of cancer. They were dragged toward that abyss in graded, discrete steps. While Bert Vogelstein was describing the slow march of cancer from one gene mutation to the next, cancer biologists were investigating the functions of these mutations. Cancer gene mutations, they knew, could succinctly be described in two categories, either activations of proto-oncogenes or inactivations of tumor suppressor genes. But although dysregulated cell division is the pathological hallmark of cancer, cancer cells do not merely divide. They migrate through the body, destroy other tissues, invade organs, and colonize distant sites. To understand the full syndrome of cancer, biologists would need to link gene mutations in cancer cells to the complex and multifaceted abnormal behavior of these cells. Genes encode proteins, and proteins often work like minuscule molecular switches, activating yet other proteins and inactivating others, turning molecular switches on and off inside a cell. Thus, a conceptual diagram can be drawn for any such protein, protein A turns B on, which turns C on and D off, which turns E on, and so forth. This molecular cascade is termed the signaling pathway for a protein. Such pathways are constantly active in cells, bringing signals in and signals out, thereby allowing a cell to function in its environment. Proto-oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes, cancer biologists discovered, sit at the hubs of such signaling pathways. RAS, for instance, activates a protein called MEK. MEK in turn activates ERK, which, through several intermediary steps, ultimately accelerates cell division. This cascade of steps, called the RAS-MEK-ERK pathway, is tightly regulated in normal cells, thereby ensuring tightly regulated cell division. In cancer cells, activated RAS chronically and permanently activates MEK, which permanently activates ERK, resulting in uncontrolled cell division, pathological mitosis. But the activated RAS pathway, RAS to MEK to ERK, does not merely cause accelerated cell division. The pathway also intersects with other pathways to enable several other behaviors of cancer cells. At Children's Hospital in Boston in the 1990s, the surgeon-scientist Judah Folkman demonstrated that certain activated signaling pathways within cancer cells, RAS among them, could also induce neighboring blood vessels to grow. A tumor could thus acquire its own blood supply by insidiously inciting a network of blood vessels around itself and then growing in grape-like clusters around those vessels, a phenomenon that Folkman called tumor angiogenesis. Folkman's Harvard colleague, Stan Korsmeyer, found other activated pathways in cancer cells originating in mutated genes that also blocked cell death, thus imbuing cancer cells with the capacity to resist death signals. Other pathways allowed cancer cells to acquire motility, the capacity to move from one tissue to another, initiating metastasis. Yet other gene cascades increased cell survival in hostile environments, such that cancer cells traveling through the bloodstream could invade other organs and not be rejected or destroyed in environments not designed for their survival. Cancer, in short, was not merely genetic in its origin, it was genetic in its entirety. Abnormal genes governed all aspects of cancer's behavior. Cascades of aberrant signals originating in mutant genes fanned out within the cancer cell, promoting survival, accelerating growth, enabling mobility, recruiting blood vessels, enhancing nourishment, drawing oxygen, sustaining cancer's life. These gene cascades, notably, were perversions of signaling pathways used by the body under normal circumstances. The motility genes activated by cancer cells, for instance, are the very genes that normal cells use when they require movement through the body, such as when immunological cells need to move toward sites of infection. Tumor angiogenesis exploits the same pathways that are used when blood vessels are created to heal wounds. Nothing is invented. Nothing is extraneous. Cancer's life is a recapitulation of the body's life, its existence a pathological mirror of our own. Susan Sontag warned against overburdening an illness with metaphors. But this is not a metaphor. Down to their innate molecular core, cancer cells are hyperactive, survival-endowed, scrappy, fecund, inventive copies of ourselves. By the early 1990s, cancer biologists could begin to model the genesis of cancer in terms of molecular changes in genes. To understand that model, let us begin with a normal cell, say a lung cell that resides in the left lung of a 40-year-old fire safety equipment installer. One morning in 1968, a minute sliver of asbestos from his equipment wafts through the air and lodges in the vicinity of that cell. His body reacts to the sliver with an inflammation. the cells around the sliver begin to divide furiously, like a minuscule wound trying to heal, and a small clump of cells derived from the original cell arises at the site. In one cell in that clump, an accidental mutation occurs in the RAS gene. The mutation creates an activated version of RAS. The cell containing the mutant gene is driven to grow more swiftly than its neighbors and creates a clump within the original clump of cells. It is not yet a cancer cell, but a cell in which uncontrolled cell division has partly been unleashed, cancer's primordial ancestor. A decade passes. The small collection of RAS mutant cells continues to proliferate, unnoticed, in the far periphery of the lung. The man smokes cigarettes, and a carcinogenic chemical in tar reaches the periphery of the lung and collides with the clump of RAS mutated cells. A cell in this clump acquires a second mutation in its genes, activating a second oncogene. Another decade passes. Yet another cell in that secondary mass of cells is caught in the path of an errant X-ray and acquires yet another mutation, this time inactivating a tumor suppressor gene. This mutation has little effect since the cell possesses a second copy of that gene. But in the next year, another mutation inactivates the second copy of the tumor suppressor gene, creating a cell that possesses two activated oncogenes and an inactive tumor suppressor gene. Now a fatal march is on. An unraveling begins. The cells, now with four mutations, begin to outgrow their brethren. As the cells grow, they acquire additional mutations and they activate pathways, resulting in cells even further adapted for growth and survival. One mutation in the tumor allows it to incite blood vessels to grow. Another mutation within this blood-nourished tumor allows the tumor to survive even in areas of the body with low oxygen. Mutant cells beget cells beget cells. A gene that increases the mobility of the cells is activated in a cell. This cell, having acquired motility, can migrate through the lung tissue and enter the bloodstream. A descendant of this mobile cancer cell acquires the capacity to survive in the bone. This cell, having migrated through the blood, reaches the outer edge of the pelvis, where it begins yet another cycle of survival, selection, and colonization. It represents the first metastasis of a tumor that originated in the lung. The man is occasionally short of breath. He feels a tingle of pain in the periphery of his lung. Occasionally, he senses something moving under his rib cage when he walks. Another year passes, and the sensations accelerate. The man visits a physician, and a CT scan is performed, revealing a rind-like mass wrapped around a bronchus in the lung. A biopsy reveals lung cancer. A surgeon examines the man and the CT scan of the chest and deems the cancer inoperable. 3 weeks after that visit, the man returns to the medical clinic complaining of pain in his ribs and his hips. A bone scan reveals metastasis to the pelvis and the ribs. Intravenous chemotherapy is initiated. The cells in the lung tumor respond. The man soldiers through a punishing regimen of multiple cell-killing drugs. But during the treatment, one cell in the tumor acquires yet another mutation that makes it resistant to the drug used to treat the cancer. 7 months after his initial diagnosis, the tumor relapses all over the body, in the lungs, the bones, the liver. On the morning of October 17, 2004, deeply narcotized on opiates in a hospital bed in Boston and surrounded by his wife and his children, the man dies of metastatic lung cancer, a sliver of asbestos still lodged in the periphery of his lung. He is 76 years old. I began this as a hypothetical story of cancer. The genes, carcinogens, and the sequence of mutations in this story are all certainly hypothetical. But the body at its center is real. This man was the first patient to die in my care during my fellowship in cancer medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital. Medicine, I said, begins with storytelling. Patients tell stories to describe illness. Doctors tell stories to understand it. Science tells its own story to explain diseases. This story of one cancer's genesis, of carcinogens causing mutations in internal genes, unleashing cascading pathways in cells that then cycle through mutation, selection, and survival, represents the most cogent outline we have of cancer's birth. In the fall of 1999, Robert Weinberg attended a conference on cancer biology in Hawaii. Late one afternoon, he and Douglas Hanahan, another cancer biologist, trekked through the lava beds of the low Black Mountains until they found themselves at the mouth of a volcano, staring in. Their conversation was tinged with frustration. For too long, it seemed, cancer had been talked about as if it were a bewildering hodgepodge of chaos. The biological characteristics of tumors were described as so multifarious as to defy any credible organization. There seemed to be no organizing rules. Yet, Weinberg and Hanahan knew, the discoveries of the prior two decades had suggested deep rules and principles. Biologists looking directly into cancer's maw now recognized that roiling beneath the incredible heterogeneity of cancer were behaviors, genes, and pathways. In January 2000, a few months after their walk to the volcano's mouth, Weinberg and Hanahan published an article titled The Hallmarks of Cancer, to summarize these rules. It was an ambitious and iconic work that marked a return after nearly a century's detour to Boveri's original notion of a unitary cause of carcinoma. We discuss rules that govern the transformation of normal human cells into malignant cancers. We suggest that research over the past decades has revealed a small number of molecular, biochemical, and cellular traits, acquired capabilities, shared by most and perhaps all types of human cancer. How many rules, then, could Weinberg and Hanahan evoke to explain the core behavior of more than 100 distinct types and subtypes of tumors? The question was audacious in its expansiveness, the answer even more audacious in its economy. 6. We suggest that the vast catalog of cancer cell genotypes is a manifestation of 6 essential alterations in cell physiology that collectively dictate malignant growth. 1. Self-sufficiency in growth signals. Cancer cells acquire an autonomous drive to proliferate, pathological mitosis, by virtue of the activation of oncogenes such as RAS or MYC. 2. Insensitivity to growth inhibitory, anti-growth signals. Cancer cells inactivate tumor suppressor genes such as retinoblastoma, RB, that normally inhibit growth. 3. Evasion of programmed cell death, apoptosis. Cancer cells suppress and inactivate genes and pathways that normally enable cells to die. 4. Limitless replicative potential. Cancer cells activate specific gene pathways that render them immortal even after generations of growth. 5. Sustained angiogenesis. Cancer cells acquire the capacity to draw out their own supply of blood and blood vessels. Tumor angiogenesis. 6. Tissue invasion and metastasis. Cancer cells acquire the capacity to migrate to other organs, invade other tissues, and colonize these organs, resulting in their spread throughout the body. Notably, Weinberg and Hanahan wrote, these 6 rules were not abstract descriptions of cancer's behavior. Many of the genes and pathways that enabled each of these 6 behaviors had concretely been identified. RAS, MYC, RB, to name just a few. The task now was to connect this causal understanding of cancer's deep biology to the quest for its cure. Some would argue that the search for the origin and treatment of this disease will continue over the next quarter century in much the same manner as it has in the recent past, by adding further layers of complexity to a scientific literature that is already complex almost beyond measure. But we anticipate otherwise. Those researching the cancer problem will be practicing a dramatically different type of science than we have experienced over the past 25 years. The mechanistic maturity of cancer science would create a new kind of cancer medicine, Weinberg and Hanahan posited. With holistic clarity of mechanism, cancer prognosis and treatment will become a rational science, unrecognizable by current practitioners. Having wandered in the darkness for decades, scientists had finally reached a clearing in their understanding of cancer. Medicine's task was to continue that journey toward a new therapeutic attack. Part 6. The Fruits of Long Endeavors. We are really reaping the fruits of our long endeavors. Michael Gorman to Mary Lasker, 1985. The National Cancer Institute, which has overseen American efforts on researching and combating cancers since 1971, should take on an ambitious new goal for the next decade, the development of new drugs that will provide lifelong cures for many, if not all, major cancers. Beating cancer now is a realistic ambition because at long last, we largely know its true genetic and chemical characteristics. James Watson, 2009. The more perfect a power is, the more difficult it is to quell. St. Aquinas, attributed. No one had labored in vain. Have you met Jimmy? Jimmy is any one of thousands of children with leukemia or any other form of cancer from the nation or from around the world. Pamphlet for the Jimmy Fund, 1963. In the summer of 1997, a woman named Phyllis Clausen from Billerica, Massachusetts, posted a letter to the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. She was writing on behalf of Jimmy, Farber's mascot. It had been nearly 50 years since Jimmy had arrived at Farber's clinic in Boston from upstate Maine with a diagnosis of lymphoma of the intestines. Like all his ward mates from the 1950s, Jimmy was presumed long dead. Not true, Clausen wrote. He was alive and well. Jimmy, Einar Gustafsson, was her brother, a truck driver in Maine with three children. For 5 decades, his family had guarded the knowledge of Jimmy's identity and his survival. Only Sidney Farber had known. Christmas cards from Farber had arrived each winter, until Farber himself had died in 1973. Every year for decades, Clausen and her siblings had sent in modest donations to the Jimmy Fund, divulging to no one that the silhouetted face on the solicitation card for contributions was their brother's. But with the passage of 50 years, Clausen felt she could no longer keep the secret in good conscience. Jimmy's story, she recalled, had become a story that I could not hold. I knew I had to write the letter while Einar was still alive. Clausen's letter was nearly thrown into the trash. Jimmy's sightings, like Elvis sightings, were reported often, but rarely taken seriously. All had turned out to be hoaxes. Doctors had informed the Jimmy Fund's publicity department that the odds of Jimmy's having survived were nil, and that all claims were to be treated with great skepticism. But Clausen's letter contained details that could not be waved away. She wrote of listening to the radio in New Sweden, Maine, in the summer of 1948 to tune in to the Ralph Edwards broadcast. She recalled her brother's midwinter trips to Boston that often took 2 days, with Jimmy in his baseball uniform lying patiently in the back of a truck. When Clausen told her brother about the letter that she had sent, she found him more relieved than annoyed. It was like an unburdening for him, too, she recalled. Einar was a modest man. He had kept to himself because he did not want to brag. I would read in the papers that they had found me someplace, he said, and I would smile. Clausen's letter was spotted by Karen Cummings, an associate in the Jimmy Fund's development office, who immediately understood its potential significance. She contacted Clausen and then reached Gustafson. A few weeks later, in January 1998, Cummings arranged to meet Jimmy at a truck stop outside a shopping center in a suburb of Boston. It was 6 a.m. on a bone-chilling winter day, and Gustafson and his wife piled into Cummings's warm car. Cummings had brought a tape of Jimmy from 1948 singing his favorite song. She played it. "Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back." Gustafson listened to his own voice with tears in his eyes. Cummings and Jimmy's wife sat in the car, their eyes also welling with silent tears. Later that month, Cummings drove up to New Sweden, a brutally beautiful town in northern Maine with austere angular houses set against an even more austere landscape. Old-timers in the town also recalled Gustafson's trips to Boston for chemotherapy. He had hitchhiked to and from Boston in cars and trucks and delivery vans any time someone from the town had driven up or down the coast. It had taken a village to save a child. As Cummings sat in Gustafson's kitchen, he crept upstairs and returned with a cardboard box. Wrapped inside was the battered baseball uniform that the Boston Braves had given Jimmy on the night of the Edwards broadcast. Cummings needed no further proof. And so it was in May 1998, almost exactly 50 years after he had journeyed from small-town Maine to the Children's Hospital to meet the odd formal doctor in a three-piece suit, that Jimmy returned with full fanfare to the Jimmy Fund. His wardmates from the hospital, the Sandler twin with his recalcitrant leukemia engorging his spleen, the blonde girl in plates by the television, little Jenny with leukemia, had long ago been buried in small graves in and around Boston. Gustafson walked into the Jimmy Fund building, up the low, long steps to the room where the clockwork train had run through the mountain tunnel. Jimmy began chemo in the Children's Hospital in 1948, but was later followed and treated in the Jimmy Fund building in 1952. Patients, survivors, nurses, and doctors milled around him. Like a latter-day Rip Van Winkle, he found the present unfathomable and unrecognizable. "Everything has changed," Clausen recalled him saying. "The rooms, the patients, the drugs." But more than anything, survivorship had changed. "I now remembered the cancer ward as a place with many curtains," she continued. "When the children were well, the curtains would be spread open, but they would soon close the curtains, and there would be no child when they were opened again." Here Gustafson was, 50 years later, back in those long hallways with the faded cartoon paintings on the walls, his curtains thrown apart. It is impossible to know whether Jimmy had survived because of surgery, or chemotherapy, or because his cancer had been inherently benign in its behavior. But the facts of his medical history are irrelevant. His return was symbolic. Jimmy had unwittingly been picked to become the icon of the child with cancer. But Einar Gustafson, now 63 years old, had returned as the icon of a man beyond cancer. The Italian memoirist Primo Levi, who survived a concentration camp and then navigated his way through a blasted Germany to his native Turin, often remarked that among the most fatal qualities of the camp was its ability to erase the idea of a life outside and beyond itself. A person's past and his present were annihilated as a matter of course. To be in the camps was to abnegate history, identity, and personality. But it was the erasure of the future that was the most chilling. "With that annihilation," Levy wrote, "came a moral and spiritual death that perpetuated the status quo of imprisonment. If no life existed beyond the camp, then the distorted logic by which the camp operated became life as usual." Cancer is not a concentration camp, but it shares the quality of annihilation. It negates the possibility of life outside and beyond itself. It subsumes all living. The daily life of a patient becomes so intensely preoccupied with his or her illness that the world fades away. Every last morsel of energy is spent tending the disease. "How to overcome him became my obsession," the journalist Max Lerner wrote, of the lymphoma in his spleen. "If it was to be a combat, then I had to engage it with everything I had, knowledge and guile, ways covert as well as overt." For Carla, in the midst of the worst phase of her chemotherapy, the day-to-day rituals of survival utterly blotted out any thought of survivorship in the long run. When I asked a woman with a rare form of muscle sarcoma about her life outside the hospital, she told me that she spent her days and nights scouring the internet for news about the disease. "I am in the hospital," she said, "even when I am outside the hospital." The poet Jason Schindler wrote, "Cancer is a tremendous opportunity to have your face pressed right up against the glass of your mortality. But what patients see through the glass is not a world outside cancer, but a world taken over by it. Cancer reflected endlessly around them, like a hall of mirrors." I was not immune to this compulsive preoccupation either. In the summer of 2005, as my fellowship hurtled to its end, I experienced perhaps the singularly transformative event of my life, the birth of my daughter. Glowing, beautiful, and cherubic, Leela was born on a warm night at Massachusetts General Hospital, then swaddled in blankets and brought to the newborn unit on the 14th floor. The unit is directly across from the cancer ward. The apposition of the two is hardly a coincidence. As a medical procedure, childbirth is least likely to involve infectious complications and is thus the safest neighbor to a chemotherapy ward, where any infection can turn into a lethal rampage. As in so much in medicine, the juxtaposition between the two wards is purely functional and yet just as purely profound. I would like to see myself at my wife's side awaiting the miraculous moment of my daughter's birth as most fathers do. But in truth, I was gowned and gloved like a surgeon, with a blue sterile sheet spread out in front of me and a long syringe in my hands, poised to harvest the maroon gush of blood cells from the umbilical cord. When I cut that cord, part of me was the father, but the other part an oncologist. Umbilical blood contains one of the richest known sources of blood-forming stem cells, cells that can be stored away in cryobanks and used for a bone marrow transplant to treat leukemia in the future, an intensely precious resource often flushed down a sink in hospitals after childbirth. The midwives rolled their eyes. The obstetrician, an old friend, asked jokingly if I ever stopped thinking about work. But I was too far steeped in the study of blood to ignore my instincts. In the bone marrow transplant rooms across that very hallway were patients for whom I had scoured tissue banks across the nation for one or two pints of these stem cells that might save their lives. Even in this most life-affirming of moments, the shadows of malignancy and death were forever lurking on my psyche. But not everything was involuting into death. Something transformative was also happening in the fellows' clinics in the summer of 2005. Many of my patients, whose faces had so fixedly been pressed up against the glass of their mortality, began to glimpse an afterlife beyond cancer. February, as I said before, had marked the midpoint of an abysmal descent. Cancer had reached its full lethal bloom that month. Nearly every week had brought news of a mounting toll, culminating chillingly with Steve Harmon's arrival in the emergency room and his devastating spiral into death thereafter. Some days I dreaded walking by the fax machines outside my office, where a pile of death certificates would be waiting for my signature. But then, like a poisonous tide receding, the bad news ebbed. The nightly phone calls from the hospitals or from ERs and hospice units around Boston bringing news of yet another death. "I'm calling to let you know that your patient arrived here this evening with dizziness and difficulty breathing," suddenly ceased. It was as if the veil of death had lifted, and survivors had emerged from underneath. Ben Orman had been definitively cured of Hodgkin's lymphoma. It had not been an effortless voyage. His blood counts had dropped calamitously during the mid-cycle of chemotherapy. For a few weeks, it had appeared that the lymphoma had ceased responding, a poor prognostic sign, portending a therapy-resistant, fatal variant of the disease. But in the end, the mass in his neck and the larger archipelago of masses in his chest had all melted away, leaving just minor remnants of scar tissue. The formality of his demeanor had visibly relaxed. When I last saw him, in the summer of 2005, he spoke about moving away from Boston to Los Angeles to join a law firm. He assured me that he would visit to follow up, but I wasn't convinced. Orman epitomized the afterlife of cancer, eager to forget the clinic and its bleak rituals, like a bad trip to a foreign country. Catherine Fitz could also see a life beyond cancer. For Fitz, with the lung tumor wrapped ominously around her bronchus, the biggest hurdle had been the local control of her cancer. The mass had been excised in an incredibly meticulous surgery. She had then finished adjuvant chemotherapy and radiation. Nearly 12 months after the surgery, there was no sign of a local relapse, nor was there any sign of the woman who had come to the clinic several months earlier, nearly folded over in fear. Tumor out, chemotherapy done, radiation behind her, Fitz's effervescence poured out of every spigot of her soul. At times, watching her personality emerge as if through a nozzle, it seemed abundantly clear why the Greeks had thought of disease as pathological blockades of humors. Carla returned to see me in July 2005, bringing pictures of her three growing children. She refused to let another doctor perform her bone marrow biopsy, so I walked over from the lab on a warm morning to perform the procedure. She looked relieved when she saw me, greeting me with her anxious half-smile. We had developed a ritualistic relationship. Who was I to desecrate a lucky ritual? The biopsy revealed no leukemia in the bone marrow. Her remission, for now, was still intact. I have chosen these cases not because they were miraculous, but because of precisely the opposite reason. They represent a routine spectrum of survivors. Hodgkin's disease cured with multi-drug chemotherapy. Locally advanced lung cancer controlled with surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. Lymphoblastic leukemia in a prolonged remission after intensive chemotherapy. To me, these were miracles enough. It is an old complaint about the practice of medicine that it inures you to the idea of death. But when medicine inures you to the idea of life, to survival, then it has failed utterly. The novelist Thomas Wolfe, recalling a lifelong struggle with illness, wrote in his last letter, "I've made a long voyage and been to a strange country, and I've seen the dark man very close." I had not made the journey myself, and I had only seen the darkness reflected in the eyes of others. But surely it was the most sublime moment of my clinical life to have watched that voyage in reverse, to encounter men and women returning from the strange country, to see them so very close, clambering back. Incremental advances can add up to transformative changes. In 2005, an avalanche of papers cascading through the scientific literature converged on a remarkably consistent message. The national physiognomy of cancer had subtly but fundamentally changed. The mortality for nearly every major form of cancer, lung, breast, colon, and prostate, had continuously dropped for 15 straight years. There had been no single drastic turn, but rather a steady and powerful attrition. Mortality had declined by about 1% every year. The rate might sound modest, but its cumulative effect was remarkable. Between 1990 and 2005, the cancer-specific death rate had dropped nearly 15%, a decline unprecedented in the history of the disease. The empire of cancer, was still indubitably vast. More than 500,000 American men and women died of cancer in 2005. But it was losing power, fraying at its borders. What precipitated this steady decline?